Hello, I'm Eddie Temple Morris.
And I'm Nick Hawkes.
Nice to have you with us. You're about to listen to episode 6 of Trailblazers, and we very much hope that you've enjoyed the stellar cast that we've had so far.
Had some great people, haven't we, actually? It's been amazing.
So this time, it's Danny Rampling.
Yeah, certainly somebody who's been very significant in my personal journey in music. He's the guy that kind of played a really significant part in breaking the first hit record that I ever signed. So I got a lot of love for Danny Rampling. And in what we've got here, it's really a taster of the great music that was significant to Danny on his journey. But if you want to listen to the tracks in full, and I would recommend that, head over to Deezer.com. They're there. And there's also special Trailblazers playlists from us and our guests that you can check out.
Yeah, some great stories coming up from a real DJ, a proper superstar DJ legend, arguably one of the very first. So let's begin.
Deezer Originals. Trailblazers, Danny Rampling.
Welcome, dear friends, to another episode of Trailblazers. My name is Eddie Temple Morris, and by my side, as ever, XL and Positiva Records founder Nick Hawkes. Together, each time we light a warm and friendly fire and invite another dance music legend like Nick to chat to us by the fireside, to talk about the cultural fires they started, and to play some of the tunes that soundtrack their fascinating lives. This week's Firestarter is founding father of modern dance music and DJ culture, one who truly blazed a trail that thousands of other DJs and producers have followed. He's conquered clubs, radio, TV, film, and you can still see his armpits in clubs from Ibiza to India. did you like that?
Well, what an accolade. What an intro, Eddie. Yeah.
Danny Rampling, welcome to Trailblazers. So lovely to lovely to see you again.
It's the best one yet, man.
It's good to see you too, Eddie, and Nick.
So as I light the fire, I'll hand over to Nick as ever to fire the first question at you.
Okay, great. So brilliant to have you along, Danny. Great that you could come to join us. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Lovely, lovely. So what have you been up to of late? I sort of keep a little bit of an eye on your movements on social media, and it all seems very glamorous. You seem to be clocking up the air miles.
Fortunately, it is very glamorous, yeah.
Good. You know,
blessed to be still travelling the world.
Yeah.
Just back in the UK a couple of weeks ago from a very successful Australian tour and
wow.
And Asia into Thailand. And they liked it so much in Australia, I'm going back there at Easter for more dates. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So should we rewind the clock and find out, like, let's just
yeah.
rewind the whole thing.
Let's
like,
do
where
that.
Where did it all start for you? Like,
sure.
What was the first record that you had an emotional response to that you can remember?
I think my love for music and radio for that matter began around my mother and my family at a young age. You know, from a very young age, there was always music played in the house. My mother would listen to the radio, Radio One. At the time, and that was my introduction to music, and I was fascinated how music was played on a record player. My grandmother had this huge cabinet record player, and you could
yeah.
put the records and store them in there, and the speakers were in the front, and there was a deck on it, and I was obsessed with that at a very young age. And they always used to have family parties at, you know, kind of whether it was a christening or a Christmas party or a birthday party, all the family would get together and dance and play music. And then I think I may have been about 7 or 8 years old, and my job was to put the records on, and they used to love the fact that I was enthusiastic towards that job while they were, you know, drinking and being merry and having a great old knees up as such in the house. And it introduced me to playing music. And, you know, Carl Cox has said the same thing. That's how he became, you know, fascinated and obsessed by playing records.
Mm.
And those records were really heavy. They were 78s. They were like acetates. They were really heavy records. And one of those records was Jerry Lee Lewis, Great Balls of Fire. So much energy in this piece of music.
Trailblazers, Danny Rampling.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I let you love what I thought it was funny. You came along and woo, now honey. I've changed my mind. This love is fine. Goodness gracious, great balls of spot.
Jerry Lewis, my God, they made them short and sweet.
They did. You must have had to be a very attentive seven-year-old changing their records, because literally everything lasts about a minute and 58.
Yeah, exactly. You had to be, really...
on your game.
Yeah, exactly, on your game. So, so back to that time, think back to it. Were you just literally this small, fleshy jukebox that you just put on records, or were you providing any chat or any performance?
No. Quick Hand Dan, I was called. No, I just used to take the records out, and then family would say, "Well, play this one and play that one," and they would encourage me.
Yeah. And where was this geographically? Where were you at this?
In South London, in SW16 in Streatham.
Oh, you're Streatham. Okay, so you're a South
London
boy.
That's where I was born. Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
So after your initial foray into DJing at such a young age, what was then? Can you pinpoint a record that really sort of reached into you in a more emotional way, rather than just sort of being a human jukebox?
Yeah, because as a kid, Top of the Pops was our point of music, and used to watch it religiously. And then all of a sudden, these pop stars burst on the scene, namely Mark Bolan and Bowie. And it was like, wow. And, there was all these glam rock artists, Slade, Sweet, Glitter Band.
Yeah.
Just a wave of this, colourful, something, something very different had emerged. And, as a kid, it was like then the fashion that went with it, there was all this sparkly fashion and kind of high heel platform boots with
were you rocking that look?
I didn't have the money to rock that look at the time. I was a kid. I was, 10, 11, I suppose. But I wanted to rock that look, yeah.
I'll tell you something about rocking that look. I remember that look was big when I was a kid too, and I wanted a pair of platform shoes, right? And my dad was like, "You're not going to no son of mine's going to have platform shoes." Anyway, my mum we went out shopping and whatever, and she was like, all right, and got me a pair of of shoes that did have really big sort of heels and stuff that, and I couldn't walk in the fucking thing. So I literally bought them, and I was teetering and whatever. It was oh my God, this is a disaster. And in the end, and my mum's like, this is not working out. I was no, I can't walk in. Whatever. And then we kept that a secret from my dad, for all his days. He's gone now, he's passed away, but he never knew that we actually went down that route,
He just wouldn't have been happy.
He wouldn't have been happy, so we just remained something between me and my mum,
I never went down that road myself. I was always beaten up by people who were wearing those shoes.
Oh, okay.
chased around Hereford, being called all sorts of horrible racist names by people in those shoes.
Well, normally in London, it was people who wore those shoes that got a tag for looking different, particularly the kind of Gary Glitter boots, the kind of big sparkly kind of the Sweet used to wear them, and Bowie, and they used to sell them in Carnaby Street, and they had big stars on, and they were covered in glitter, and I saw them, and they were way beyond my budget, but I just drool at them in the window. I never got a pair, but I spent all my money on music as a kid. It started at a young age. I used to be given record tokens as presents and gifts at birthdays and Christmas, and that would all be spent on going to the local record store and buying vinyl,
seven inch singles.
Yeah.
So you were basically, you were sort of collating at that time a glam rock archive of 45 singles.
Well, that was the sound for most kids at that time. It was a new revolution, really.
And
I think, 11 years old, seeing this burst on, these characters burst onto the TV screen was very influential. And particularly one character, Mark Bolan. I had posters of all these artists on my bedroom wall, and it was like, I want to be a pop star like them, like most kids did, either an astronaut or a pop star. I ended up being a DJ, which is even better.
Trailblazers. Yeah.
Rex, Telegram Sam, from an era where, which of course was so different, because in terms of being, of absorbing music, I mean, you touched on it, there wasn't much choice, was there? It was like Top of the Pops.
The radio.
Everybody watched that, you know, there was Radio 1. Where else in that era were you?
Well, youth clubs. No,
yeah.
Clubs, that was about it, or junior discos.
Yeah, yeah, no internet. Or, you know, very different times, very different times. So then what? Then tell us a bit more, like, when you became, you know, you moved into your teens and you were sort of growing up, how did things sort of change there? Did you engage a lot more with music and DJing and all of that? Did you become the guy who was playing the tunes at the youth club?
I wasn't DJing then, no. I was just an avid record collector and a lover of music and used to, you know, go out and try and get into clubs at like 14 years old and often get refused entry to a club, but it would always be a game of one time you'd get in, then 10 times you wouldn't. So
were you memorising sort of fake dates of birth and thing? I remember doing
well,
a bit
absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely, I looked about 8.
Oh, right. So most
at 14, I looked about 8 years
most
old.
Most of the time. Do you remember the time that you first actually blagged your way into a club and you actually got in and you're like, oh my God, I'm actually got through the doors?
Yeah, it was at the Crystal Palace Hotel, which was a grown-ups club.
Yeah.
And I got in there, I think I was about 14 at the time, and one night I got in and I was hooked. It was like, wow,
yes.
I want to come here every week. But I didn't get in there after that for a while because I think someone had blown my cover and told them I was like not old enough to be in there. I went back there the next week. It was like, sorry, you're not coming in. You'll have to come back when you're old enough.
Come back in 3 years' time or something.
Yeah, I had a few more goes at it, but the door was closed for a couple of years. But, through my teens, collecting music and, you know, being influenced by, you know, kind of music as a whole and fashion. Mm. And I wanted to be a DJ, but just didn't know how to get in there and do it. And there was a friend who lived down the road, a guy called Tony Cox, and we were about 14, I think, at the time, and he got the whole console, the flashing lights and the two decks.
Yeah.
And it was, wow, you've made it. You're now a DJ. And I was quite influenced by him as well, and I thought, well, I'd love to do that, but didn't know how to do it. I was a lot more shy at the time. And he got this contract in a local working man's club, and he became a DJ, and then he went off and worked on the QE2. And we're still friends to this day. But he was very influential as well. And I thought, well, you know, he's gone off and done that, and I just really I had the motivation, but I had a bit of fear surrounding it.
Yes.
It wasn't till later on that I became a DJ, but it was just collecting music and going out to, you know, to parties and clubs and enjoying music. And then about 15 and a half, I left school and came to work in the city as an apprentice carpenter, and I hated every minute of it. And, I thought I'd like it, and I got to work on this job, and it wasn't for me. And it was, I needed to be in music. And then punk came along, and that was it. It was a big turning point.
Okay.
At any point during these years where you were obviously such a lover of music and you were avidly, vigorously collecting and consuming it, was there any point at which you thought, I want to do this? Like, because you're very musical. So was there any time where you formed a band or wanted to play an instrument or anything like that?
Well, I used to listen to the radio all the time. And when I was kind of 12, 13, I'd be listening to Luxembourg and, you know, when I should have been sleeping for school. And, you know, Tony Prince, he was one of the DJs on there.
The Royal Ruler.
Who created Mick Mag and DMC.
DMC, that's right. Yeah, DMC Tony.
So I used to listen to his shows and stuff and the other DJ shows and just have this romantic vision of, like, being out somewhere far. And, you know, Radio Luxembourg wasn't actually on the ocean, I don't think. That was Radio Caroline.
No.
But I had it in my head that it was a ship out in the Channel or the North Sea, and you'd be living on the ship. So it was an adventure. So I used to have that vision in my head. And, I wanted to be a DJ, a radio DJ from a young age.
Not in a band. It was all about...
That came later. When punk arrived, that was it. It was like, try to tune in a guitar and drop out, basically. Not tune in, drop out. It was like tune out a guitar and drop out. So went to work and saw this like slogan on the wall, you know, God Save the Queen and Anarchy in the UK. And that was around the release of, you know, used to pass this estate in Brixton, the Stockwell Park estate, on the bus going to work. And there was all this like punk graffiti on the wall. And it was just, the whole thing was like blowing up then. It already started in 76, but it like,
Did you become a punk yourself?
I did,
then?
Yeah,
right,
I did.
Did you do what I did,
which was, I ask guys to remember this, I was just coming back to me, I took my flare jeans and I took them to my mum and I asked her to cut a massive triangle out of the bottom of them and then stitch them together to make them into drain pipes.
Oh, brilliant.
I couldn't afford to go, you know, down the Great Gear Market in Kings Road and buy a pair of proper, like, you know,
no,
drain
pipes. Yeah.
I remember my mum going, you want me to do what? What? Sure. You want me to? Because everybody was wearing flares. Everybody was wearing flares. And you know, when I did that, it was like, really? You want to wear straight trousers? Like, what is wrong with you?
Well, your mum supported you.
Yeah.
Bless you. Bless you, Mum.
So you were a punk.
I certainly was, yeah. Well, okay. I think, you know, kind of like punk was really like an exciting movement. And I think it changed so many people. As we were just talking, it was real DIY culture. It was like, you know,
totally.
Get up, form a band and like drop out of you know, your crap jobs. It's like, and that's what people did. And I did the same thing. I walked into the college where I was. I got there 10 minutes late. The instructor said, you're 10 minutes late. I'm reporting you to your company. I said, well, you go ahead and do that. See you later. And I walked out and that was the end of my job with them. And I learned to play bass guitar. Well, badly. Learned to play bass guitar and formed a band called the Prime Suspects. But I think we were better at our marketing than actually kind of getting gigs. And we didn't actually play a gig. We just like used to rehearse all the time.
Okay.
But we plastered the whole of the London Underground in these yellow stickers that were, you know, we spend hours handwriting them up and plaster them. And people were like, who are the Prime Suspects? It was a band that never played.
Yeah. We've never seen them. We've got to see the Prime Suspects.
And you've been building demand ever since.
Exactly.
The biggest wind-up campaign ever, yeah.
Well, this is very interesting because there's obviously a very clear similarity culturally between punk and acid house, really, in terms of the DIY, of it being very exclusive and unattainable for most normal people.
Very much so.
You had to have a studio. You had to, you know, get demo time from a major record label in order to get into a proper studio to record anything. And punk suddenly, and it was all sort of session musicians and long hair and platforms and all that. And
prog rock.
Suddenly, exactly. And then suddenly it was like dynamite on a dam.
Exactly.
It?
Yeah, people were forming bands and getting opportunities that they previously could have only dreamed about. And that just, you know, the whole scene exploded and this whole wave of new bands came out and there were gigs every night in London. You know, go to like the Roundhouse, the Marquee,
some of the
Croydon Greyhound.
Did you see some of the key?
Well, the Adverts, the Clash, the Damned,
right?
Even the Jam were on the scene at that punk time as well.
Yeah.
But all of those, Generation X, Billy Idol, X-Ray Specs, you know, all those bands. I went and saw Adam and the Ants at the Marquee. That was always a popular one because there'd be a lot of stage diving there. And all those concerts, kind of in the, you know, that formative years of live music and going out to gigs, because I hadn't really been to concerts like that, you know, in the live band circuit up until punk.
And then you were just immersed in a wave of gigs and action.
And energy, and as many kids were, it was, you know, it was a very exciting movement at the time. You know, the whole anarchy thing, it was like, you know, just drop out and do what you want, you know, kind of, but it was, you know, that was inspiring to people. It was like, okay, well, let's do what we want and let's, like, live the life we want. And that's what people did. And that's why all these great bands emerged. And, you know, the fashion and the scene that surrounded it were very similar to acid house some years later.
Did you ever catch the Sex Pistols?
No, I didn't catch the Sex Pistols, unfortunately. I just missed that kind of first wave of punk. Mm. Used to read about it in Sounds and NME, but unfortunately missed those Sex Pistols gigs. I mean, that must have been amazing to have gone to them. It's like the early Acid House clubs, you know, everyone claims to have gone to one of those Acid House clubs, but the reality of it was there was only like 300 people in the club I co-created with Shume. And, you know, the same for like Future with Paul Oakenfold, 300 people at the time, the early club. So, you know, it's the same thing. But, yeah, I would have loved to have seen the Pistols. I saw them some years later in their reforming, that when they reformed for that tour, I think it was like 10 years ago.
The Filthy Luca tour.
Finsbury Park, wasn't it? With Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
It was a good gig.
Right. Yeah. What a shame that you missed them right at the beginning.
But loved their music, you know.
But you were exactly consuming their music. So, should we play something from the Jubilee to take you back to the Jubilee? Take us all back to the Jubilee year.
There you go. God Save the Queen.
Trailblazers. Danny Rampling.
God Save the Queen. The fascist regime. They made you a moron. Potential hate bomb. God Save the Queen. She ain't no human being.
Sex Pistols and God Save the Queen to take us back to the Jubilee year. Thanks to Danny Rampling, our trailblazer. So, Danny, you've catalogued you've soundtracked your life up to this point by referencing a lot of rock music, of glam rock and of punk rock. So, dance music wasn't really a thing back then, but there was a sort of a divide culturally between kind of, you've got mods and rockers and you've got soul boys and funk people and, you know, those guys. So when did that world, because that world is obviously much closer to the world that you're famous for. So when did you kind of dovetail with soul music or dance music culturally then?
I think, you know, the roots of dance music, Tamla Motown. The first Motown record I bought was Stone Love by the Supremes, which I love dearly. And that was my influence to the soul sound. And then on from that, going ice skating at like 13 to 15 years old, and there'd always be disco music played at the ice rink, and there'd be a speed skating session. Everyone who couldn't skate fast would leave the ice, and then the show-off speed skaters would go round the ice rink.
Yeah, that's a hard one. Why was it? It was always dance music. Actually, thinking about it, it was always dance music in ice skating rinks, never rock music, right?
Exactly, yeah. It was disco and funk and stuff, yeah. Because I don't remember much rock music being played. There was a bit of rock and roll. The Sidewinder used to be played, but there wasn't any kind of like heavy rock or rock that was played.
Happened. Do you think that there was like one really influential DJ that was playing in all of these places playing in these ice? That there might be an unknown DJ from an ice skating rink that you know is
very likely.
Others.
There's some kind of awful gag about dance music being cooler and ice rinks. Like I said, it is an awful gag, which is why I'm not going to go down that route.
But I guess one piece of music that sticks out from that time, and particularly the disco influence, the Sound of Philadelphia, MFSB, that reminds me of those days, and I think that kind of opened my ears a lot more to the disco sound as well, and that was one of the first influential records that I can remember from my teenage years, skating and listening to this piece of music.
And did it make you, because the glam rock and the punk rock and stuff very much sort of empowered you and inspired you.
Absolutely.
Did this do the same thing? I mean, how did it make you feel at the time when you kind of engaged with this kind of music?
I think, you know, that kind of music was more about chasing girls.
Yeah, of course. So
flirting and like, you know, kind of drooling over certain girls and falling in love with them and then not actually getting in love with them or actually getting a date with them.
Well, let's rewind you back to that terrible moment in your life.
Trailblazers.
Well,
Sounds of Philadelphia by MFSB. So, now forgive my ignorance. Would this be called soul music or rare groove, or what would you? How would you categorise it? What category in the record shop would you find this record?
Is there a category for it? It comes under the rare groove banner. It comes under soul music. It comes under disco.
Yeah. So here's you. This is the mid 70s now. And this is a palpably more 4/4 disco beat that has entered your life. But of course, you were still, you know, inspired by the glam rock and really into your punk rock. You were really into your rock music, but now you're getting into dance music as well. And so and in those days, the culture was very separate, wasn't it? Like you were a punk or you were a soul boy. So kind of you must have felt a bit confused.
Or you was a rocker.
You're a metaler or a rocker, you know, your leather jacket. So like, where were you culturally at that point then? Were you a punk that just liked soul music?
Well, no, there was a lot of people that liked disco and soul music that used to, you know, go to the Lyceum, the Lacey Lady and Crackers and all these clubs, and punk arrived, and, you know, bands like The Clash were a fusion really of kind of, you know, reggae and disco, and there was this kind of, I think that the kind of part of the tribes merged, you know. There was like a lot of people that were into disco and funk music who got into punk and loved the energy of punk, and that's what, you know, really happened. And then that also happened years later with Acid House. You had the whole rare groove scene that was, you know, a continuation of those days, that there was this whole crowd that, you know, went to the Soul Weekenders and the Warehouse parties and Shaking Finger Pop and everything else that was going on at the time, and then Acid House came along, and then there was, like, you know, this shift from that group of people that enjoyed that music into the Acid House scene. And then the whole thing merged again, and it was like history repeating itself. But yeah, as I said, you know, the 4/4 beat, Tamla Motown was my early introduction to that. And then through those days of, like, you know, going to the youth club, going skating and what have you, and being at friends' parties and house parties, and disco was often the soundtrack, disco and those funky records.
Yeah, thinking back to that time, you had sort of musical agitators like Don Letts who are introducing punks to reggae.
Exactly,
You have the DJs that you've mentioned that were kind of blurring the lines between the tribes, which is a very modern thing, but that's kind of where it started happening, wasn't it? So what was, is there a record that you can pinpoint at that time, so during the punk time, that was a pure dance music record that really, you know, that...
Absolutely, because, you know, buying 7-inch singles for many years, and then it was the introduction around, from my own experience, around 76, 77 of the 12-inch single, the extended dance single.
Yes.
That was high on the wow factor, you know, after years of buying 7s, and then 12 inches had arrived. It was like, wow, you know, 99p for like a 12-inch record with like a 7-10 minute epic mix on it.
Yes.
And one of those tracks was on TK Records, T Connection, Do What You Want to Do. And that was also a soundtrack in a club that I used to go to. And being, you know, kind of in awe of the DJ that was in there playing all these American imports. And that was one, I think that was probably the first American, one of the first American imports that I bought. Is this track
Trailblazers?
Want to hear more of the music?
Don't forget, you can listen to the tracks in full by heading over to Deezer.com,
where you'll also find special Trailblazers playlists.
Deezer. Originals. Trailblazers.
So, T Connection, Do What You Want to Do. So I'm interested in how you would access dance music in this point or over the next sort of few years. You said that you bought this record as a import 12-inch. Were you hitting the specialist stores, Groove Records or City Sounds, whatever it might have been, Bluebird possibly?
Yeah, I think that was around 77, 78. I went to a record store in Croydon called Diamond Records, and that was a leading import store in London at the time, and that's where I bought these import 12 inches, and that's where I bought my first import album, which was Isaac Hayes, New Horizons, brilliant album. So I used to shop there a lot, and that was kind of this, like, created this passion for, you know, that sound and the music that was there available.
Yeah.
So I got into collecting that music. Punk came along, got into punk, and then, you know, followed the live gig circuit for a couple of years, and then punk became more leaned towards the mod scene, the Jam, and all of those Purple Hearts and those bands, and then went on that scene and got on the scooter scene and all of that for, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. And and then it was around 81, I think it was. About 81, start of 82. And then I met Nicky Holloway shortly after, who introduced me to Kiss FM radio.
Right.
Yeah, I think that was around 83, I believe.
So that would have been a pirate back then.
It was, yeah. It was one of the original London pirates, along with JFM and Horizon and Solar Radio at the time. And Kiss had a lot of DJs that had worked on that on those other stations. Gordon Mack created Kiss, and Nicky was a friend of Gordon's. Mm. And I'd sent Gordon in a top three on another station. He was on a JFM one afternoon, and he liked my top three. And Nicky said, oh, he's a mate of mine. So I got a show at 2 o'clock in the morning on Kiss, because I had a record collection. I was collecting soul, independent soul music then, post kind of like punk mod, and went into collecting like funk and independent soul. And stuff and, like, you know, deep soul from the south.
So you were on Kiss as a pirate, but you weren't DJing in clubs, interestingly.
No, I wasn't, no. Ah, still aspiring to.
Expect it to maybe be the other way round, that you're out there DJing and then you get your radio break. But for you, other way
round. It was the other way round, yeah.
Okay.
But you were living your dream, because from when you were a kid, you wanted to be a radio DJ,
I did. And then, fortunately, through Nicky's introduction to... and through sending in this selection to Gordon Mack, the station controller, the 2 points connected, and then I was off to show, because he was looking for DJs. So I got a show, I think it was Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, 2 in the morning till 4.
And talk us through...
Red eye slot.
Probably not many people listening, but it was like, you know, it was a good training ground.
So talk us through, what was the environment then of sort of mid-80s London pirate radio? Were you in a high-rise block, or were you in the back of some
We were in a block of flats. Well, that's one of the first shows that came from there. I played in Wandsworth. There was a building in Wandsworth. But they originally started in Charlton. There was a few shows there, because it was a high point in London.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very basic back then as well, you know, compared to what radio is today. And it was the early foundations and a continuation of the other pirates, like Caroline and Luxembourg, but continued in... in the cities of England, and London was leading the way generally with the pirates, alongside Manchester and Nottingham and other places. But here in London, first place was Charlton, then it went to Wandsworth, then it went to Walworth Road, and in southeast London. So I got a break there, and I pursued that break and stuck with it. And
Were you concerned about getting raided and all of that as a pirate radio station at that point?
Oh, that was always talked about, and there were a couple of raids, but it wasn't in the middle of the night. It was always when it was like a primetime DJ on, so the middle of the night, it was like, you know, there was no point raiding it at that time. It was to cause maximum, you know, impact on the station listenership and the station as a whole. So, you know, the weekend DJs and the primetime DJs who were the stars of Kiss, well, there'd be the odd raid, but Kiss wasn't raided a great deal, actually. Equipment was confiscated a few times, but they never had, like, there was a couple of other stations that were raided continually, but Kiss seemed to, you know, kind of bypass that some way, somehow. So, you know, there'd be talk of it, and, you know, what happens if there's going to be a raid on the pirate station?
We actually all thought
it was quite fun, because it was a cat and mouse game with the authorities, and it would
constantly
be like...
they're trying to triangulate
exactly.
And I think they would always raid in the day, for the pure and simple fact that everybody knows that anyone who works for the council stops working for the council at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, that must be it.
So it's just working hours. They'd get you in working hours, wouldn't they?
And who...
Interesting experience, yeah. You know, and that was the introduction to radio, because I was incredibly mic shy at the time as well.
Right.
But, it was, I've got a microphone in front of me. Do I have to talk? Yes, you do have to talk. So this is what you have to say. You know, it's like, talk about the radio station, and like, there's some things to read out. So, you know, kind of like at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, making mistakes. I listened back to some of the early recordings. It's, God, is that me? Yeah, that's you.
Do you remember who else was on the station at the same time as you then? Kiss as a...
Trevor Nelson.
Right, okay.
Tim Westwood?
Yes, Tim came to Kiss. I think he came a little bit later, but yeah, Tim was on Kiss. Norman Jay.
Right. Colin Favour at
Colin
this
Favour,
point?
Colin Favour, indeed.
Yeah,
Colin
okay.
Favour. Bobby and Steve.
Got it. So it was a really strong lineup of talent, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. Jonathan Moore from Cold Cut.
Oh yeah! Wow. Yeah. And at that point, so you were saying with a little smile in your face, you were saying that you were playing like sort of slushy, kind of like late night kind
exactly,
of swing beaty
yeah.
soul, right?
Yeah, so, the lovers' selection.
yeah, something for the ladies. So at that point, were you experimenting at all with mixing records or beat matching, or was that kind of thing starting to, you know, how did that, because what had happened in New York with Kool Herc and Grandmaster yeah. Flash and stuff, which obviously massively affected the whole sort of hip hop and mixing and scratching yeah. and cutting and stuff, sort of, when did that kind of come into your life?
I saw Paul Anderson play on a Kiss gig, Paul Trouble Anderson, an incredible mixer, and it was like, wow, you know, that is the way to play music. That, and also listening to Froggy on JFM, who was like known as the master mixer, and he'd play like the New York master mixes, but he wouldn't copy them, but he had that style of mixing as like, you know, the New York, what the New York sound was all about.
And they phasing the records, the repeating, yeah. the
and long mixes and yeah. lots of editing that went into them. But, you know, he was a master mixer, God bless his soul. But that was an influence on many of us here in London, and Paul Trouble Anderson and Mastermind Roadshow. You know, they're all mixing up records and that influenced so many of us, I think, you know, those early pioneers of mixing tracks together.
Yeah, so it's such an interesting time. Is that a lot of people sort of think back and credit the hip-hop guys with the sort of the origination of kind of mixing. But you mentioned DMC and Tony Prince, and DMC stood for Disco Mixing Championships.
That's right, yeah.
It's not now it's Dance Music
Club.
Yeah, there you go. So it's something that actually came from disco, didn't it?
Yeah.
The culture of mixology, you know, of mixing.
Well, yeah, disco and hip-hop.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, the scratching and stuff came from hip hop, but it was that sort of mixing thing, such a strong thing with disco.
So when did you start moving into club world and DJing in clubs?
Right, I was on the radio on the late night shifts, and that continued for a couple of years. And I think I got a Sunday afternoon at some stage, 3 or 4 years later. And then I was playing in bars in Southeast London, and then I met Nicky Holloway in Ibiza around 83, and
we formed a friendship. Let me just stop you on that one. So was that your first visit to Ibiza was 1983?
My first visit was 81, but 81. The visit in 83 is where I met Nicky and we became friends, and then I became...
Was that this special...
Assistant.
Was that the special branch Ibiza sort of...
Yeah, that came a bit later as well. He was promoting all these parties in London at the zoo, the special branch in warehouses and in Southeast London, and then he did some Ibiza trips as well.
So you met Nicky in Ibiza?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
right.
That was outside of his special branch activities.
Okay.
So he was a strong influence, and he's a great friend. And he gave me an opportunity to learn about promoting nightclubs and what goes into the logistics of promoting a nightclub. And he taught me a lot. I didn't get a gig at his events generally, and I learned from the ethos of promotion.
Yeah.
And that helped me greatly when I started Shoom in 1987.
So were your first club gigs around that era, sort of 87, 86, 7-ish?
They were. The first club gig I did was with Kiss, at Kiss's in Peckham. They used to do the Sunday night Kiss at Kiss's. And that was a regular gig for the station. So there was one event that we... a lot of the kind of lesser-known DJs were invited to play early on.
Okay.
So I was, I have to say, I was absolutely nervous that night. It was the first gig in the club.
Yeah,
and I only played about 15 minutes of music.
Right.
We all did. But it was like, it was a good turning point.
Yes.
It's like, yeah,
okay,
like,
I can do
like this. You know, you're playing in this club and you've got all these respected figures in there. And it's like, well, who's this bloke here? It's like, well, they're like the kind of like the junior DJs on the station.
Got it.
But Gordon was very, very encouraging to the new talent like myself and other people on the station.
So I can see, I can imagine you getting rolling on sort of that front. Can I just ask you briefly what your experience of Ibiza was then, both on that very first visit? Did you say 1981 for you?
I first went in 81, yeah, with
a
girlfriend.
Did you go clubbing in Ibiza in 1981?
No, I didn't, no.
Right,
I went there to a hotel and didn't see that side of the island.
Right.
I was,
did that side of the island even exist? I mean, like...
Well, yeah, I didn't know about it then in 81.
It just must have been bars and...
I think...
It did exist,
But when did you first kind of experience Ibiza club culture then?
I think properly, you know, kind of that side of it, Amnesia, and in 87.
Right.
I went off to America for a year in... 80, when was that? The end of it was the start of 86 into 87. I went to America for a bit of an adventure, basically, and lived there for a year and came back. And then
I didn't
house
know
was
that.
Blowing
I didn't know
up.
You lived in America.
East Coast or West Coast? Right. Where did you go?
I started off in LA, but couldn't really kind of adjust to that and didn't have much money. I sold a lot of my records to Trevor Nelson and Jonathan Moore. I collected a lot of rare growth. Well, right, okay, well, to raise the funds. Because it was very economically depressed as well in Britain in like the mid-80s.
Yeah, of course.
It wasn't a great time economically. No, and, you know, you had the punk thing where there was no future and it was... You know, there was a continuation of that. It wasn't great. It wasn't ideal, really. And we were doing our own thing. So I went off to America and stayed there for about a year. And I first went to LA for a, only lasted about 2 weeks. Took the Greyhound bus for 3 days non-stop across America and ended up in Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and then later Key West. So that was my American trip.
I was doing something similar. I was in America summer of 80. Yeah. Summer of 87, I was in America.
Oh,
as well.
Right.
I was in New York, though. Yeah, and just for a few months.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I didn't...
Paradise Garage.
Yes, I visited once, just a few weeks before it closed.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't... I was kind of... travelled around, but generally New York based. But it was very exciting, wasn't it, to be in America at that period of time?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah, incredibly exciting. But unfortunately, I didn't have the experience of the Paradise Garage. And
I was lucky.
That's the one club, I think, that I think it's the only club that I would really have loved to have gone to.
Although I've got to say, and when it comes up in conversation and I talk about it, Larry Lan was playing the night that I was there. He was pretty shit, to be honest. It was like, you know, bit of clanker janks, you know, and there was one point where the record got to the end and it was like... like this, and this went on for minutes, you know, and people just stood on the dance floor.
He got away with it, though, didn't he?
Well, he got away with it. I mean, I think he was
revered as a legendary DJ, and he could get away with that. You know,
he could. Like, I think he was sprawled under the decks, and somebody had to rush up and sort of give him a shake and say, Larry, mate, you know, well, put another tune on. But...
Well, he was a rock and roll DJ, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. So that was my experience of the Paradise Garage. So,
brilliant.
And then Ibiza Clubland. Tell us about when. So Amnesia. Yeah, your first experience of Amnesia was 87.
87. Yeah, August of 87. I came back from America. I think it was in June of that year. Nikki did this special branch thing in Greece.
Mm.
So we went there, and you know everything was changing, and the music had changed in the course of a year. You know, house had, you know, really kind of started to come in, and DJs like Colin Favour and Steve Jackson and Jazzy M were playing it on pirate radio, and it was like fresh and exciting sound, because in America, down there in Florida, it really wasn't being played.
Mm.
So it was like, wow, you know, this is house. You know, I'd read about it and stuff and kept up on music whilst away. And it was like, wow, this is like, you know, this is brilliant. And we went to Ibiza to celebrate Paul Oakenfold's birthday. It was his birthday, so the four of us went with Johnny Walker, Nicky Holloway, myself and Paul, and had this week there and had this, like, you know, complete revelation of On the Dance Floor and Amnesia. And that, you know, that was, you know, an incredible experience coming from London warehouse parties and soul weekends into, like, this cosmopolitan melting pot of hedonism and open air and beautiful people and scallies from Europe and people on Eurorail tickets, you know, blagging their way around Europe. There was this English contingent. Yeah, there was about 20 of them. There was a little gang of them, you know, from Sheffield and Manchester and London. And they were all pretty cool. And Nancy Noyes was part of that group and Lisa Loud. And they were all friends with Oki as well. And Alfredo inspired us greatly. Argentinian DJ playing in the open air in this little shed at the end of the dance floor. And it was just magic, pure magic. And the stage was set. It was like, well, we need to do this back in London. And one of those tracks that really stands out is Kenny Jam and Jason, Can You Dance? I think this track taught a lot of people how to dance, actually.
Trailblazers.
So Kenny Jamming Jason and Can You Dance? And this is, I presume, this is a New York record or a Chicago?
Chicago.
This is Chicago House. So at this point, I presume that the Roland TB-303 was about to be invented, but hadn't actually been invented yet? Had it been invented? Were you guys using that then?
Oh, it had, yeah. I mean, Acid Tracks, future Acid Tracks, there was quite a wave of Acid Tracks around this other more pumping, you know, Chicago sound as well, this house jacking sound.
Yeah.
So you had the 303 sound, and at the same time, tracks like this, and James Silk and Farley Jack Master Funk and Frankie Knuckles that were more gospelly based and their roots in disco, and Acid House 303 sound was more had its roots in the electronic bands like Kraftwerk and Depeche Mode and those electronic bands of the 80s. So that formed the basis for the techno sound, the Detroit techno sound, and the Roland 303 acid sound. All of those producers were influenced by European bands.
Yeah. So now you mentioned Paul Oakenfold. Now, obviously, in the sort of genesis of British dance music culture, you meeting Paul Oakenfold, that's a big pin in the map in the sort of in dance family trees. So when did that happen? How did you guys meet? When did you become friends?
I knew Paul through Nicky, and Paul used to play in bars and clubs around London, and particularly South London. And he introduced Def Jam to the UK. So at his time at Profile Records and New York, and the whole Def Jam sound and tour was introduced through Paul, namely.
Really? God, I thought it was Tim Westwood who did that.
And that was like in the early 80s. So Paul was very influential in that as well.
Yeah.
So he was a bit of a face around town, and, you know, kind of didn't know him that well until we went on that trip. You know, we used to talk, and he'd give me some white labels and stuff. We used to work at Rush Release, but it was that trip in 87 where I really got to know him, and that was it, really.
And so I guess we must be getting very close to you starting the club that, if you had a poll, you mentioned this earlier, if you go on Facebook now and go, who was that Shroom originally, you'll get probably 10,000 people who will go, yeah, you know, I was there like week one, but that, you know, that there was only, you know, 278 people in that room.
Yeah.
So when did that, what did that start in 88?
No, in 87, in December 87.
Gosh.
We came back in Ibiza. We all said to each other, we're going to do this back in London. And that's what we did. We created our own, respectively, our own clubs. I'd been working with Nicky long enough to kind of build my experience. I hadn't run clubs before, but I'd helped run them. And I thought, I'm going back. And I heard this name on the dance floor. It was like, you know, Shim, Shim, Shim. Well, that's a name for my club. That was it. It was Trevor Fung who said that. Who's, you know, another Early Acid House DJ. He's, you know, Shimmer's like, that's the name I'm going to have for my club. And I came back, and we all came back, and you know, things snowballed very quickly. You know, you had the Pirate Radio playing it. You had the Wag Club were playing it, Rene Galston, Black Market at the Wag, and Black Market Records was one of the finest record stores for house music in London.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were parties going on, and then Colin Favour was playing at Jungle Club and Pyramid, which were mixed gay clubs with Mark Moore and at Heaven. And all these new tracks were coming with, you know, Mars, Pump Up the Volume, Dave Durrell and CJ McIntosh produced that, Tim Simonon, Bond the Bass, and Mark Moore's S Express. So there's this whole wave of British stuff coming through as well. And the whole thing just...
exploded,
just,
really.
It just came together so quickly. You know, this whole huge wave of, like, this new sound and this new movement had gone from, like, a few people in clubs to, like, thousands within months.
Yeah, I remember going
to Heaven.
Hundreds
of thousands.
I remember going to Heaven back in those days on the one day a week. It was either a Wednesday or a Thursday. I think it was called Asylum.
Yeah.
And it was the only time when they let us breeders in. They would let straight people into this really iconic gay club. So Shum, was that... was that in Vauxhall that you started?
It was in Southwark Street, close to Southwark Bridge. We opened that in a gym. I'd played there at an engagement party around 83, I believe, 84, and said this would be a great place for one day when I actually do have a club and a crowd. This is where I'm going to do this this club. This is where I'm going to hold the night for this club. That was my dream, was to have, just to be playing music to a crowd of people that appreciated it and having that core crowd. And, you know, I'll always say it, that's worth, to me, you know, worth more than anything money could buy, because I had fulfilled my dream and my ambitions to...
I've got to ask, did you know, though, that it was going to be successful and packed and all that, or were you nervous opening up the club thinking, you know what, I hope, you know, people show up and...
Absolutely, because, you know, the first night I did it in conjunction with a Rare Groove DJ, and he had his crowd.
Right.
And a few of the people I'd met in Ibiza and through these other places in London we're going to, they came along. So there was only about 100 people there the first night, and there was a great divide in the music and the crowd. He played Rare Groove, I came on and... attempted, you know, to play house to a crowd that were not really into house. Part of the crowd was, so it was a bit of a divide. And that was the November 87, December the 5th, 1987. So that was reviewed, and then with my wife at the time, Jenny, then went on and restructured things, and it was 88, it really came together, and that's when it really, really boomed. But, you know, kind of in the space of, like, you know, two parties, three parties, Cole Cox played on the second party and put his sound system in there, and then I invited Colin Favour, who was a hero of mine, and to come and play as well, leading house DJ at the time and just techno DJ.
The Carl Cox thing is interesting. So, yeah, what was Carl doing? He played at the second Shum, did he?
That's right, yeah. And Carl was playing at Paul Oakenfold's club, Ziggy's in Streatham.
Right.
And he was the opening DJ, and he had something to do with the sound system there. And I saw him play there, and he's playing, you know, on three decks. It's like, wow, he's, like, you know, really good.
Right.
And got friendly with Carl, and then he came along and played as well, and then that was it. You know, the stage was set.
Yeah.
And within weeks, with all the clubs, with the clubs that Paul did and Nicky did, you know, it went from a small core group of people, just these seeds, to, you know, to this people, you know, queuing around the block to get in.
That must have been amazing. Been amazing for you to turn up at the fourth, fifth Shum and see a line just all the way down the street or whatever, and...
Well, it was a great feeling. It was like, how are all these people going to get in here? But I didn't have anything to do with the door, so fortunately, my role was to entertain people downstairs and make sure the party was rocking and, you know, kind of host with people. But so that was no easy job on the door, though, that's for sure. You know, lines of people and a room that held 300, and even that was a squeeze. You know, there was a lot of disappointed people.
Filled it three, four times over.
Well, exactly, but that wasn't the ethos of the club.
Yeah.
And if we had have done that at the time, I think it could have fizzled out quicker than it did. We didn't go for the commercial angle on it, and, you know, it was about the music and the club itself, and it attracted a lot more attention because it was so difficult to get into for a lot of people because of the capacity.
Of course.
The capacity to get into the space. So Clink Street opened up around the corner. So there'd be like this kind of like flow between the clubs, and Clink Street went a lot later. It went till 10 midday, and it was a much bigger space.
When did you wrap up typically?
At 5.
Okay.
Yeah, so people used to either go there, or people who didn't get into the club because it was you know, full to capacity would go to Clink Street, and other you know, that area became a hub. And Southwark Street at the time was an industrial area. It was a rundown part of London, and now today look at it, you know, it's a, you know, a gleaming metropolis of, like, you know, of the South Bank of London.
I'm interested to know how it kind of how the fire spread, because this is before the internet. And so how are all these people finding out about this? Was it purely word of mouth, or were you being very clever about flyering, or was there a radio show that was how did people kind of, how did the community form? Do you have a sense of how that happened?
Through pirate radio. That was a strong underpinning platform that promoted the scene itself and the music and the outlet for the music. So a lot more shows had emerged on pirate radio, including my own. I'd gone from, like, as I said, a graveyard shift to a Friday afternoon shift, so I'd made it, basically. And flyers around London, you know, it was a very word-of-mouth thing. But then, you know, that's how it built. And later in 88, the newspapers picked up on it, the tabloids, and first they were supportive of it, and, you know, kind of then they started scandalising it. That was more late 88 and into 89. But that actually increased the interest in the scene and the naughtiness of it. And we all want a part of this, you know. People would be at work on Monday morning and their mates have been out, like, raving all weekend, and they'd say, well, I haven't been to sleep, I've just started coming to work. And they'd be reading about it, you know, in the tea break or whatever, you know, the lunch break. Well, where can we go? Let's all do it. So, like, you know, it just, like, create this mass wave of, like, sensationalism and hysteria, and people wanted a part of it. And the tabloids actually helped build the rave scene. Really kind of, without, you know, unwittingly,
and kill it eventually, perhaps.
Well, yes, exactly, yeah. But, you know, everything comes to an end at some point. But it was great while it lasted. But the actual rave scene, I didn't really participate in a great deal. You know, I was happy with my club, and that was it. You know, as I said earlier, I found my dream, and that was it. And that was. I got offered a lot of money to play on huge raves. And it weren't about the money for me. It was just like, I don't want the money. I'm really happy where I am here, and this is fulfilling to me enough. I'm not just doing this for money. This is about my years of, like, trying to be a DJ and then having a crowd to play for and keeping that crowd with me, and which I did for about, you know, I'm still friends with a lot of those people today, but like 2 or 3 years, that crowd stayed very tight with me as a DJ and with the club. Well, longer than that, into Pure Sexy and Glam at the Milk Bar. A lot of those people used to go to Shoom. So that crowd stayed very loyal for 10 years because of my thinking and my approach to the scene as well. Yeah, I didn't want to go off and just take the cash and come out of a rave with a bag load of cash and, you know, kind of, you know, get paid, like, you know, thousands of pounds for doing that at the time. That came later, getting paid, you know, paid really, really good money in the 90s with the whole super club thing. That's when it, you know, that was a continuation of the rave scene.
So what was the record? We're in 88. It's all exploded.
Yeah.
What is the tune that soundtracked it for you at that point? What's the tune that you want to sort of to highlight from that period?
I think the one that really captures the spirit of Shoom, and particularly from my own, like, you know, kind of memories of DJing there, I'd go into a trance to this piece of music, which is the Night Riders, Let the Music Take You to the Top. And that's exactly what it did to millions of us and continues to do so today.
Trailblazers.
So it's 1988. It's all gone off for you. You are Danny Rampling on Friday afternoon on KISS. You are the pivot of, you know, the coolest and most exclusive and the club that everybody wants to go to in London. So roundabout at this time, or not shortly after that, you two guys dovetailed. Your lives kind of came together in some way, didn't it?
Yes, it did. So I was aware of what Danny was doing. I've been listening to him on Kiss and aware of the momentum and buzz and everything that Danny was creating. I wish I could claim that I was... that I was there at Shum, but I wasn't. I didn't go, and I don't know why, but I just, you couldn't go to everything. And
probably because everyone told you couldn't get in. You can't get in. You'd be queuing for hours. It's awful.
Nick would have been most welcome.
Yeah. So no, that was... Danny mentioned he didn't make it to Paradise Garage. I didn't make it to Shum.
Yeah.
But I did make it to Ibiza in the summer of 88, kind of inspired by... a lot of what Danny and the other guys had been doing. So I'd been to Ibiza briefly in 86, and then I chose to spend the summer of 88 in Ibiza, and I just felt that was where I needed to be. But I think what you're referring to in terms of the dovetailing, our paths hadn't crossed at that point. Our paths crossed, I think, properly for the first time, where I went to see you DJ in Windsor. In some kind of
Studio Valbon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that Maidenhead?
Maidenhead.
Sorry,
Studio Valbon.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was there, and it was, I think it was like a Sunday afternoon into evening type session.
Promoted by Tommy Mac. That's right.
Yeah.
Was this a carry on? Was this one of those ones where everyone's been at a place like that and they want to carry on?
I think it was for a lot of people. Yeah.
So
certainly was.
So I was aware, the buzz, and Danny was doing all this stuff, and so I went down there on a Sunday afternoon with got a lift with a couple of sort of journalists that I knew, a couple of NME journalists actually, Jack Barron and Helen Mead.
Oh right, okay,
yeah, and so we come to the club, and I'm hanging out, and everything's great, and then I hear this record come on, and I by this point in my career I was doing club promotions and A&R for a label called City Beat, which was a sort of fairly eclectic dance sort of bass label, and I heard Danny play this record, and I'm like, oh man, everything exploded, and I thought, oh, I've got to find out what this is. So I go sprinting over to the DJ, start peering over the deck seat to try and find out what this record is, and it's a white label, and Danny has inscribed "Fuck Off Nosy" on the white label.
That's a true story.
That needs to be put onto a t-shirt.
yeah. So, and I'm like, oh, it became clear I wasn't gonna, sort of easily find out, because you were one of only, I think, three or four people who had this particular record at the time.
I went to Italy and bought a lot of music. I went on this trip to Italy for a week just to buy music, and found all these great, like, Italian records at the time, these Italo house records. And that was one of them. And I thought, well, I'm not just going to come back and let everyone know what it is. Let's play it, let's cover it up, and let's build a buzz on it. So actually I was doing the artist a favour and the record label, because it created, like, at the time, like the Northern Soul scene, it created an allure around, a mystery around the record, and people wanted it.
Yeah, and so what I had to do on Monday, so this was Sunday, I'd come home, I'm like, I don't know what this record was, but... No Shazam, yeah. Whatever. So then I phone up Trax Records, Richard and Craig, who had their little store Trax, and I start singing the record down the phone to them. And I go, either Richard or Craig said, yeah, that's Numero Uno by Starlight, but there's only like three people that have got that in the UK. I'm like, oh God. So it was impossible to kind of hit, how can I hear it? And then he goes, well, Danny's got Danny Rampling, obviously, yeah, he's playing it, Trevor Fung has got it, and maybe one other person possibly. So we knew Trevor Fung, Tim, my boss at City Beat, we phone up Trevor Fung and say, Tim calls him up and goes, Nick heard this record in a club on Sunday, says it's really good, but we can't hear it anywhere, but we're told that you've got a copy of it, is it possible, can we hear it somehow? So Trevor brings his copy of Starlight Numero Uno down to the City Beat office, plays it, in front of me and then my boss at the time, Tim. Tim's like, yeah, well, that is good, isn't it? And then we contact the Italian label, Disco Magic, and arrange to license the record for £2,000 advance, what have you. And then that became the first hit record that I signed.
Wow.
Giving me one of the highest moments in my life ever, which was... when we released the record, it went in at like number 39 in the charts, and records sort of climbed up. You know, and I remember listening to the radio on the Sunday, and I didn't know what the final chart position was. And the DJ kept going, no, and in at 29 it's this, and in at 21 it's that. And I started, and I thought we had a really hot record, but he got up to about number sort of 20, still hadn't played it, and I then started to get really depressed. I'm like, oh my god, how can we fucked it up? It must have dropped out of the charts. How can that happen? It was like the hottest record. It's not in the top 40 anymore. And then it was like, and the highest climber this week from 39 to 17 or 16, whatever, Starlight Numero Uno. And I absolutely lost my mind. I literally was cartwheeling through the hall, just going, you know, truly.
What a great feeling.
Oh, it was an incredible buzz. So, you know, I was just like, wow, I've signed a hit record and it's just like the hottest record in the chart this week. And so that was one of my dreams coming true that I'd had as a child, a little bit like your, you know, dream of DJing and being on the radio and all that.
That was the one that did it. And Daniele Divoli, who produced Black Box, he was behind that record as well.
Yeah, same team.
It went to number one, didn't it?
No, Starlight Numero Uno. No, not that. No, Black Box was number one for sort of 6 weeks.
Did Numero Uno not get
to
number one?
No, we got to about top 10. Yeah. Top 10 record, but no, it wasn't.
But it sold 100,000 copies because you gave me a gold disc for that record.
Yeah.
I think that was the first gold disc that I'd ever received.
And
I was
richly
like,
deserved.
Wow, I'm going to put this on the wall. It's
great.
Like, I was very proud, and it's still on my wall today. Other gold discs. You know, it was a trophy of recognition and thanks for this support, breaking and supporting this record.
Yeah.
Wow, look, I've got a gold disc. I was like so proud of it.
Yeah. It's lovely. It's lovely when that happens.
So,
let's enjoy that. And you've got a picture now, Nick cartwheeling down the corridor.
Trailblazers, Danny Rampling.
Numero Uno, and that's the second time that we've had Daniele Divoli, lovely man, mentioned on this show, because of course Mike Pickering was heavily involved with that lovely Italian man.
Yeah.
So we've talked about Nick, how you when your life dovetailed with Danny's. Mine dovetailed with Danny's a lot later.
Oh, right.
In the mid 90s, I was at Radio 1.
Right.
I was the jingle dude. I did all of the promos and the trailers and all of and to the identity of the station.
Yeah.
And the then boss drafted in, wanted to sort of shake up the kind of DJ, reflect DJ culture a bit more.
Yes.
And he brought in Tim Westwood.
Yeah.
And he brought in, amongst others, Danny Rampling.
Mm.
And I remember, you know, what should we call the show? And I remember coming in from my first meeting with you and just saying, you know, do you want to call it Danny Rampling, or, you know, do you want to call it something else? Do you want to call it Shoom? What do you want to call it?
You two were discussing what your Radio 1 show would be called.
Yeah, because that was my job, was the identity of the station. So I would not just make jingles, but I would make beds for them, for people to talk over and stuff. So often the first time a record might get played on Radio 1 in the mid-90s was on a bed that I'd made for a DJ.
Okay.
Or you know, and certainly I would ask someone like Danny what he wanted to call the show. And I remember him saying, I want to call it the Love Groove Dance Party.
That's right.
And
brought back some memories, some strong memories here.
Yeah.
And it was very encouraging, you know, coming into the BBC. It was like a bit daunting, I have to say.
Yeah, I guess it must have been for you.
I'd been there for maybe a year or something like that, so I sort of got my foot under the door a bit. So, what memories are you having of that? What memories am I evoking by saying this then?
Well, it was all very quick, moving from Kiss to Radio 1 in a matter of weeks. And, you know, coming from speaking to London, then to the whole country, it was, you know, a big step forward, exciting step forward. But, you know, you know how the building looked at the time, you know, all that history in Broadcasting House.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting to that stage of radio, from starting from pirate radio late at night, getting into the, you know, the Tower of Power, BBC Radio 1. But you made me feel very welcome there, and so did John Peel when I met him early on in that building. But it was quite an imposing setup as well. The first show was you'd have to walk under this tunnel across one Clipstone Street, I believe it was, into Broadcasting House. And the first show came out of this huge radio broadcast studio under through the tunnel. And
yes, right, yeah.
And the equipment was very Radio 1. Mm. The faders were reversed.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. Really old BBC desks and stuff that we had to use.
If I remember right, there wasn't Technics 1200 turntables in the studio on the first show. So we winged it, I think. That's what happened.
Yeah.
But after that show, that was all adjusted, and then we got a mixer, proper mixer in there, DJ mixer and Technics 1200s. But, yeah, actually getting onto Radio 1, and then shortly after they launched his billboard campaign, and you know, I was going to Leicester one night, and it's like I didn't even know that this billboard was going to be there.
Oh yeah,
someone's going to tip me off. I just looked out the window, and there's a picture of me sitting in the studio saying, "I'm a dance music DJ or something along those lines, not a chat show host."
Oh, that's right. Yes, I was on that campaign as well.
Good grief.
That was Radio One as it is campaign, where they sort of put a glass window into the whole place, and they wanted to not just have the DJs, the famous DJs that were there.
Some of the producers.
They wanted producers and stuff like that. So I've got it. I have somewhere at home. I was on there with Joe. Like Joe Wiley was on one half, and then I was on the other half. We were sort of like, it was a kind of a bantery sort of thing. And I remember that feeling of I was coming back from down the M4 and seeing myself on this 48 sheet poster on the M4, which was quite a bizarre thing for a producer.
Being the only person in the room who's never had his face plastered on a 48 sheet poster. Tell me then, Danny, how did that feel? Because now you're becoming kind of famous, right? Your pull as a DJ, you know, you've been used to having your crowd that's loyally followed you within London and a bit of Maidenhead, whatever you. And now I'm presuming by this point, are you on the circuit of are you doing Cream?
Yes, I was already on that circuit.
Gatecrasher, whatever.
Yeah, but it platformed me to a much wider audience and internationally. But yeah, the first show, it was like, you know, walking out at Wembley to play the cup final. That's I haven't played the cup final, but it must be along those lines.
It's your equivalent. It's
like, exactly.
Thereof, right. Yeah.
And there's a lot of support there, and there's, you know, the producers and, you know, kind of the technical staff. And, you know, coming from Kiss, there'd just be you and a producer, and everything was there in a small studio, just a little bit like this, and you'd get on with it. And that was it for a few years at Kiss. And the audience in London, it was just London and a bit of the southeast. It was like, you know, speaking to just a family, really, as such. A small, you know, it felt a lot smaller. But then Radio 1, it was like, you know, there's millions of listeners out here potentially, so we're not going to get this wrong.
It's a big time.
But I stepped up and walked through the tunnel and the hallowed tunnel of the BBC got into the studio and everything was like cool. And the station controller came in and wished me well. And it was like the first show on Radio 1. That was on a Saturday evening. I think it was quite a warm day as well. And then the first track I played was Barbara Tucker, I Get Lifted.
Trailblazers, Danny Rampling.
Happy Days. So there's the first track that ever got played on the now legendary Love Groove Dance Party at Radio 1. presented by Mr. Danny Rampling, with jingles supplied by yours truly.
Great.
So Danny, the question that we, it's been wonderful talking to you and catching up with you and getting, you know, the soundtrack to your life. So the question that we ask everybody that we talk to as the last one is that you've got to imagine that aliens have landed,
yeah,
and that they for some reason want to destroy the Earth, as you know, aliens.
They're pesky
aliens. So you have one chance, one record to give to them that will persuade them that mankind is worth saving.
Mm.
So what would that record be?
Mankind is worth saving.
Yeah.
We're under attack.
Yeah.
Well, we might not be under attack. It could be more of a scenario of like they're thinking about it. Like,
sure,
imagine they're surveying this part of the cosmos for some kind of intergalactic superhighway, and they've got to blow up a few planets to make room for it. So,
or the human race has attacked them.
So
clear off, you're aliens. So, okay, if we're under threat, if it's, you know, this massive threat, then it would have to be Wagner, the Ride of the Valkyries. It's, you know, Apocalypse Now, Bridge Too Far, military marching music, go get them.
That would surely make the aliens destroy the world, wouldn't it?
Well, I think it would make them flee.
It would be an incredible soundtrack to the aliens destroying the world.
We're under attack. It's a collective effort, and that's the soundtrack.
Okay, well, so you've chosen a classical piece of music,
yeah,
and through your whole life, we haven't, you know, where, did classical music figure, or were you like me? Did you pick this because of Apocalypse Now?
I picked that through military connections. I was in the Territorial Army in the early 80s. So, that's another part of my life. And I think that I love classical music as well. And the fact that particular piece of music, it's from an opera. It's a great piece of music. It's got lots of energy again, and it's very powerful. It's been used in some great films as well, like Apocalypse Now and Bridge Too Far. It's a battle march, and if we're under attack, then we can't run away. We're going to have to go into battle with these alien forces. But God knows how that would happen, the way the world is at the moment. It's a pretty divided place we live in. So collectively, yes, in an ideal world, a global collective, and the world is under threat, that would be the theme tune.
Yeah, I can. This is a tune that would rally anyone from any country.
Yeah.
Danny Rampling, a true trailblazer. We can see your trail through the sky that so many have followed. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Dan.
Trailblazers.
Originals.
Trailblazers.
Thanks for your ears. We hope you enjoyed Trailblazers. We love your feedback. So if you want to get in touch with either of us, you can reach out to me via Twitter at EddieTM. That's EDDYTM.
Or you can reach out to myself, Nick Hawkes, NickHalkes, on Twitter or Facebook. And remember, we've just given you a taste of the great music that shaped the journey of our special guest today. If you want to hear music in full, head over to Deezer.com and you can find special Trailblazers playlists that Eddie and I put together and some special stuff from our guests.
And bear in mind that if you enjoyed this stuff on Trailblazers, you'll definitely enjoy the curated playlists that happen on Deezer.
Just download the app for free and search for Trailblazers, or head to the dance section,
where you'll find a playlist for just about any genre you can think of in dance.
Trailblazers.
Thanks so much to Danny Rampling for joining us.
Next time on Trailblazers, the legendary Daniel Miller.
Deezer. Originals.